This is Karen Brewster, and today is March 2nd, 2022. I'm here with Sam Dementev for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act Project Jukebox, and Bill Schneider is also here to join us on this conversation. So, Sam, we wanted to talk to you about your involvement with land claims and the implementation after it was passed, and your work with all those different organizations.
Yeah, that's, I'd be very happy to talk about it. You know, when I was asked to think about the Claims Act and how it came about and when it was implemented and the implementation and how different things took place, I had to stop and think about that for a while, and goes back to, I thought about, well, the thing that really I remember was, of course, 1971, 1959, and when I was a kid. But I then thought of, oh, okay, well, it goes back to the time when the Native people, that the village chiefs along the Tanana River and Yukon River were being bothered by explorers, not explorers, but prospectors coming up the Yukon River, heading to the Klondike. So they either came up the Chilkoot Trail and went across over to Skagway up there, or they went all the way around Alaska into the Yukon River, and from there they took steamboats all the way up the river to into Canada, where the Klondike Strike was. Now, on the way up there, they were seeing cleared areas, and they would stop and camp or stop or see, oh, here's some old building or something. So they started using camps, fish camps, and seasonal camps of the Native people in some of the villages, close to some of the villages. And those people started seeing their camps being used. And they come down, in fact, there were people camped there. So they complained, told the chief, you know, see, there's some guys down the camp. And as it built up, there was more and more people. And they had one thing in mind, and that was go up there and get the gold from the Klondike, and we'll just bypass all of this stuff here, which was Alaska. Just camp wherever you can and get on into Alaska. So, but as those complaints built up, the Tanana chiefs met together and said, gee, this is something that's, okay, we hear some, you know, some of our people are complaining about people using the land, camps, and other parts of the village. We need to do something about it. Yeah, and they said, well, they got this federal judge, federal judge in Fairbanks, Wickersham. We'll go up and see him. So I made the journey up there and met with Wickersham, and he said, yes, I understand. I heard, and there are people coming into Alaska and into Canada for gold, and they have one thing in mind, and that's to dig in the streams and get the gold, regardless of whatever property they're on, if they file a claim. So anyway, the that, I believe, was the start of the Native people claiming or saying, this is our land. These camps are places we use. So I think that initially that was primarily the first claims of identifying lands that they use and occupy, which not only included along the Yukon and Tanana rivers, but also along the southeast Alaska, as people came up along the, from Seattle into the territory of Alaska. So this goes back to 19, 06 and 04 when Fairbanks was first established. And so it was after that that the 10 Chiefs met with Wickersham. But if you think about, I continue to think about that, I also think about, okay, when did this act, this federal act, really take place? And I think there was lots of talk early in the 1940s because of World War II. A lot of people don't think about World War II when it comes to Claims Act, but military coming into the territory of Alaska ended up in Anchorage, Aleutian Islands, and down at Nenana, and into Ladd Air Force Base here in Fairbanks. Those were military sites. And the Lend-Lease program, those planes that they transported from the lower 48, Seattle, into Canada, and then into Northway, and into Fairbanks, Ladfield, and then right on to Nome, and then across to Siberia, and then to Russia. So that was when people started really coming through and using and occupying the territory. So that takes an understanding. So those different things that took place in history really didn't consider Native people and land. They knew, they meaning the federal government, which purchased Alaska from Russia in 1867, they knew that this territory was theirs. But there was lots of activity from that point on. But when we think now to where we are today, and when I was asked to talk about the Claims Act, I thought about how long the Native people have been in this land. And I remember reading about the discovery of human remains on the bluff up the Tanana River Valley here at Shaw Creek, mm-hmm. towards Delta. When you drive up there 70 miles at Shaw Creek, up on that bluff, is where they discovered two infants, young babies, in a site which they were excavating. At UAF and other archaeologists. When they DNA sampled those remains, they were Dena Athabascan people from this area. So that all the people here, it is directly descended from them, or not from them, but they were here then, which was 11,000 years ago. Mm. I remember, people saying a long time ago, saying, well, we've been here for thousands of years. And I would think, well, how the heck do we know we've been here 1,000 years? Well, the saying was that we've been here 10,000 years. Now this thing actually is proof. There it is, right there. And when we talk to Howard Luke, we all know Howard Luke generally, and he talks about the use of this valley and how they used to chase caribou and reindeer down the valley and had fences from here on down towards Nenana, and they corralled the reindeer and the caribou towards the Healy area. And so they funneled them in, and then they were able to get them. So this goes, that's just a little bit of history of what we're talking about as far as the territory and the land mass that we call Alaska. Now, when I think about directly to the Claims Act itself, I graduated from high school in 1959, and there was talk about the land, and I was just a teenager then, and of course not really interested in what's going on with the business of land, and that's up to the older people that run the villages and the country. But as the federal government became more interested in Alaska, and as they were exploring it, they discovered up on the north slope of Alaska in what is called the Native Arctic Research Lab, it's called NARL, they discovered gas and oil in seeps close to Barrow. And so they sampled, drilled, and they found oil. And so they, meaning the federal government, selected land there as a federal site for oil, potential oil and gas development. And so there was a segment of land dedicated to oil and gas development. Now, as time went on, in the 1960s, they started further looking for oil, they meaning the oil companies, and they were going further towards the east from Barrow. And in 1968, the Atlantic Richfield Company drilled into an oil body and found out there's lots of oil, and drilled another well. And they have their seismic data, and they look at the oil where it looks like a great big oil body underneath, and they said, well, if this is oil and we're here on this one end on the west side, we can follow this whole line and drill on the east side, and we can confirm that there is a mass of oil underneath there, which they did for what is called Sag River Number 1. And that was in 1969, I think it was. And I remember that because I hired on to Atlantic Richfield in 1969 and went to work up there for them. And there was 30 billion barrels of oil and, you know, a huge amount. And so the whole thing was declared. Now, this is important for us to think about and remember, is when you have that much oil potential for a nation, that's security. That's national security if you have that much oil on that you own and occupy. So the government declared the North Slope and that oil area national security interest. Now that takes precedent over anything as far as relates to land in the whole of America. The federal government said, this is our national security. This comes first before anything else. And we need to get that oil out of the North Slope and get it down to the refineries and get it into our government, into lands. And of course, you have the territory government here. And there are natives claiming land in different areas, including the interior and the North Slope. And they said, well, what is it? You know, what do we have to do? And they said, well, we have to talk to them. And they said, yeah, we have representatives. We have a couple of senators and a congressman. And they got busy and said, saying, well, geez, we better talk to Native people. And so we need to, so they gathered together people from around the state to meet in a group in Anchorage, I think that was the Fairbanks. And then they talked about it, said, well, let's get all the Native people together in Anchorage, which they had the first Alaska Federation of Natives meeting, then named it that, Alaska Federation of Natives. And there are people from all areas of the state there. And so, and this was getting towards 69-70, and the need to expedite these claims and settle them was on the Native people and the territory of Alaska. get this stuff settled so we can get that oil to the United States so we can. And so the Native people had to start quickly meeting and finding out, and so they, that's how they started AFN. And AFN started dealing with that, saying, well, we need to claim the land. And so it was something that was not, certainly not the way people worked in the villages. They were living off of the land. They were living hunting and trapping and fishing and on the land, the use and occupancy of the land from their history. And now they're having to claim the land. And a lot of elders are saying, oh, we don't, what do you mean we have to claim the land? We don't claim the land. We use it. And we have. So there's lots of discussion about the use and how and why and what we should do as far as the land is concerned. And so for a lot of people, a lot of older people said, we can't, you want us to say it's ours. Well, we don't think like that. We don't say it's our land, our kids' land, and our people come up down. We all trade and we have barter systems. We work with people on the coast. We work with people in the southeast. And there are trails, and there are ways that we travel all over. And so, if we claim land, what do we have to do? Well, of course, you know, all these things related to the, how do you, well, they, how do they do it down, how do, well, how do Americans do it? Well, they put up fences. Fences. They have to go out and survey it. Survey. Holy cow, you know, how do you survey Alaska? And so you could see the problems that the Native people were talking about. A lot of them, some of the Native people did not speak English. So you had to have translators. So this thing had to be expedited. So if you think about 68, 69, 70, and 71 was when the Claims Act passed. So you have 60. They're, now these guys, the people are working 68. They're already working on this, seeing what it is because of the T10 Chiefs Conference identifying this. So now it's a real push, a big push. And there's a book called Alaska Native Claims, and it talks about the history of this whole thing we're talking about.
That's by Bob Arnold.
That's by Bob Arnold. Yes, and so. How did I become involved in this? Well, I became, as I worked for ARCO, I became more interested in reading the paper about the meetings that were taking place, and all of the young people that I grew up with that were becoming leaders in the Alaska Federation of Natives. And I started wondering, geez, well, this is going to be a big thing. And as I continued to work with Lent Richfield through 68, 69, and 70, in 75 was when, after the Claims Act passed, I was seeing how the Native people had, because of the Act, they have to implement it. How do you implement this claims, and how do you, and you have to establish some means to develop, and so there was a discussion about, well, we could do it through nonprofit organizations, and people are thinking, non-profit organization, what do you mean? That's like the Fairbanks Native Association and the 10 of the Chiefs Conference, which already were being established. So we take the land and build, make something like that? They said, yeah, that's one way. Or you could establish profit corporations. And so they would use the Alaska statutes, Title 16, and look up how corporations are formed, and they're all there, all the different types, nonprofits and profit corporations, and how they work. And so that was dug out and spread around, and so I remember the big discussion that took place at AFN, and how shall we establish these corporations? And so there was a big discussion on that. They said, well, we all have to go back and have regional meetings in the regional corporation villages, centers, and talk about that. And as the time passed, I remember the discussion saying, well, the nonprofits could own the land, but how would we own the land through a nonprofit? And so they said, well, the way that would work, we could all have 100 shares of what would be termed life estate shares. So that means that as long as the person is alive, they have 100 shares. And it would be 100 shares, just to start the thing out. Normally everybody has 100 shares. And so life estate means that when you're born and you qualify and you're enrolled to the BIA, and they're setting these determinations up, your enrollment, your 100 shares are active, and you can vote 100 shares for whatever reasons you're running your business for. And if you pass away, those life estate shares dissolve. So you don't have to worry about a person having to will them to someone else. So it eliminates the idea of, as new Native people, kids are born, they automatically would inherit or would get 100 shares of life estate. So that sounded very good. I remember hearing that, and I said, man, that just resolved this whole thing about what happens if you die. If you have 100 shares in a profit corporation where you have stock, and that stock is owned by the corporation and each stockholder. And if you die as a profit corporation stockholder, those shares become inherited or transferred to your family. Now, you can transfer the whole 100 shares, but you wouldn't do that because you have one. You could have, if someone just has a man and wife, then it's them too, and that's it. But usually there's family. And so back then there's a lot of families, pretty good sized families. I came from a family of 10. So if my dad died, you know, his 100 shares would be 10 shares each. So now, okay, all of a sudden in the first generation, your ownership in your corporation is 10 shares. Whereas other people have 100 shares. So there's a big difference in what are called Class A shares versus Class C shares. So Class C's are just children. Mm-hmm. C class. All the kids get 10 shares. So people say, well, you know, the big discussion, if I inherit shares from my grandma and grandpa, then I get 300 shares. So anyway, the whole thing related to shares is still an issue today. And when I finish talking to you, I'm safe the future for where we are 50 years now, today. The big issue for me, I believe, is shareholders. because the regional corporations have opened their roles to include Class C shareholders. So the value of your corporation, where it was 100 shares per Class A shareholder, is now, it diminishes. It's reduced because you're expanding your shareholder group. So now instead of having 10,000, you might have 15,000. So your value at share at 10 is up when you're at 15 is down. And as you go in future, the value per share is decreased more and more. And so you can see how this thing, and I admit there are now what are called, I can't think of what exactly they're called, but they're shares where one share is cut, is divided up into pieces. So anyway, it's a big problem, because now you have new kids even born today, and they, how do they qualify? They don't. They do not. They are not part of the Claims Act in the village or regional corporation. So there's a big deal right there. I want to identify that. That to me is something that the corporations, and you talk to the young shareholders now, the ones running the regional and village corporations, and they'd rather keep this thing the way it is. But how do you include young and new people that are born into your family, because they're excluded? And the further you, the more people you, it just goes up. You could see the whole thing just diminishing out to them. So there's a big question. But let me get back to where this implementation of the Claims Act, as it passed, and all the corporations, and mainly they were identified as 13 regional corporations, 12 regional corporations that own land in Alaska, the whole landmass of Alaska, and their areas they use and occupy. And then there are thousands of Native people in the lower 48 and in Seattle. What about them? They live there. What about them? So there was established a 13th regional corporation for them. Doesn't own land, but it qualifies for dispersion of funds. So you have 13th regional corporation that's landless. And I don't know how that, anything about that, because I wasn't involved in that. But so now you have, each of the villages have the ability to claim lands for the village. So how many villages are there? There's close to 200 villages, a little bit over 200 villages in the state of Alaska now, and back then, territory and state, in the state of Alaska there's. So each of them qualify for land as it relates to how many shareholders there are in a village. So if you have a large village, you get more land. And so there has to be a meeting between the regional corporation in an area. Let's use Doyon Limited. All of the interior of Alaska is Doyon Limited, the regional corporation. And there are almost 30 some villages in this region, and they have to sit down with Doyon and saying, well, we're choosing. There was an understanding that they meaning Doyon and the village, would checkerboard ownership around the village site. Checkerboard meaning Doyon would own a block, village corporation own a block, and so your idea is to own all of, control all of this land mass around the village. See how you just kind of block out land around the village to help control this area. So that had to be worked out. And so now you can see the magnitude of what the corporations have to do as far as identifying the boundaries of their lands. And so they're surveying. I mean, just, you'll have to go out and survey the land, and you certainly cannot fence it off, because there's millions of, I never thought about trying to do that, but identifying them. And so there was, that's a big thing. And so after I worked for ARCO for 5 years, I quit and hired on with the Alyeska pipeline, worked on the pipeline, because the pipeline was now under construction. And the whole state was being, and building this pipeline right down to, from Puerto Bay to Valdez. And we all remember, I think, the big thing the pipeline was, and it still is today. And to get the whole thing, when we look at this, you have to step back and say, get the oil from Puerto Bay to America. Get that oil down here. And so now you have to settle all the land things, which we're doing, and all of us. If you look at a village, and if you look at a region, the region elects their board members coming from rural areas and urban areas. So most of their people that were identified as having an education or ability to know what to do in business and development were younger and were located in the urban areas. Some living in the rural area, in the villages, but so in our, we had to identify those 11 original Doyon board members coming from representative of the whole area, so they had to have people coming from the rural areas and have to have people coming from the urban areas. So there had to be an understanding. We have urban and rural seats. And then once that happened, then the villages they're out there and they're saying, well, we have to do the same thing in each village. I'm from Holy Cross, and I remember the Holy Cross people down saying, well, we need to do something. We need to hire people. And in the meantime, some money, and I have to stop for a minute and go back to the beginning when the Claims Act was there. How does AFN work with the Congress of the United States in the implementation of this establishment of this act? They had to go out to meet with the Congress. And so they had to have money to travel. AFN has no money. Where are they going to get money from? People had to pay their own way. They had to borrow money to go down to Anchorage to go to these meetings. Now, as this identification of needing funds to implement this became obvious to the Alaska Federation of Natives, they were approached and talked to the Tionic people who lived right across the inlet from Anchorage, and they had a land settlement and they had money from their reservation, and they were willing to loan the Alaska Federation of Natives funds to work to get this land settlement established. So they loaned money to them. And so now AFN had funds to travel back and forth. And so that's how that took place. There was a loan from another settlement. And thank God, Tionic was agreement to do it. Said, yeah, we want to help out. And so now, who do you send back to meet with the in Washington, D.C. with the Congress of the United States, and we don't even know who's who and how and what an act is and how an act is established and who does it, who writes it up. So there was a lot of fast activity, and that's why you need a lot of alert young people, and older people that knew how to work this were the ones that were involved quickly to the regional corporations. So now, what did the village corporations do? So they had to look around their village, and young people that were coming out of high school and that were maybe in UAF in college, Sheldon Jackson, Mount Edgecombe, all these villages or schools, try and look for young people that could, they could hire in the village, that lived in the village. And so they needed money, so they said, well, we meaning a bunch of village corporation presidents met together in Fairbank. And I think it was 1974 that there was a meeting of village corporation presidents here in Fairbanks at the new Doyon building with the Doyon Corporation president, who was John Sackett then. And they met with him and told him that they wanted to, they are required to establish their corporations, but they don't have, we can vote people in as board members, but we have no funds. We don't have any money to get together. We have settlement money that's a few $100,000, but we need help. And John Sackett, as the president, said, I think that you, village chiefs, should consider establishing a nonprofit association with the primary goal of working to establish the villages, village corporations into business entities that need to deal with land, business development, legal issues, issuance, and other things that are required for a village to operate a corporation. And, well, they said, well, gee, that sounds like a good idea. How would we do that? He said, you hire a group of professional people, a landman, a lawyer, business development person, other specialties needed to run a corporation in the village. And as you hire this core group together, each village would approach this an interior village group. And hire those guys by giving them money from their settlement funds. These core group of professionals would contract with each village and help them out. And so that was established. It was a good stroke, and it was a good thing from Sackett, from President Sackett to the villages to do that. And so that established what is called the Interior Village Association. And I think it was, you know, the early 1970s that was established and was starting to work with village corporations in the interior. I don't know how other regional corporations or regional areas did, how they established theirs, but there was a time in the act where regions could meet with the villages and merge. merge all of the villages in with the regional corporation and just have one corporation. And by then, larger villages realized that depending on their population, as a larger village, they get a larger settlement. So they said, well, the larger villages wanted to go on their own. They thought they could do this. And so some, I think the Nana region, I think they merged. I think they have one regional corporation there, Nana, and one village corporation. One of the larger villages there is a corporation. So I don't know how the rest of the regions did, but they worked some way. So, as this was going on, I became more interested because I was working on the pipeline here, and the pipeline was built in 678 or around there. As I worked for the pipeline, it was now pumping, getting ready to pump oil through the pipeline. And I was working on it out at pump station 8, which is out here by Eielson, north of down the highway from Eielson, up at pump station 8. And the pump station was already in. And I was a pipeline technician operator, and I was working there. And we were getting ready, we meaning our LES, getting ready to oil in the pipeline and getting it on down. So they were, we were all alerted. We all, by the way, went to lots of training in order to run the pipeline, operate the pipeline. I went to university for a term, a year or two under oil companies, helping the University of Alaska establish a certificate program, and I graduated from that, and that's how I got hired onto ARCO. And then, anyway, the oil was introduced, pump coming down, and I don't know if you guys remember or not, but there was an explosion at pump station 8, and I remember we were getting pump oil coming into pump station 7, which is up on the banks of the Yukon River, and then it would come down and be in pump station 8, which would be right down here where our. And I remember we got ready, and I got off shift, and 12-hour shifts, got off, came into town, and I was over in the Doyon building, and I was in there visiting someone. And they were listening to the radio, and they said, "Sam, aren't you working for the Alyeskan?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "You work at Pump State, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." They said, "Oh, the radio was announcing that you need to all the Pump 8 off-duty technicians need to report because there's a big trouble there. There's a fire and a blow-up." And so I jumped in my car and headed on out there, and sure enough, you know, there was a leak and an explosion, and the station burnt down. And it was just weird. All of us in Pump 8 were farmed out to other pump stations to work there while Pump 8 was being fixed. But right after that, I realized that I could get a job because I was visiting people in the Doyon building. So I went to work. I applied for a job with the Interior Village Association. And that is working with the villages of the interior of Alaska. And so I got hired on, and our job was to go to each village, talk to the village board, talk to them about their business development, their stock records, their land claims, their business development, and their different policies on how and what to do. So So it was just lots of basic implementation of ideas on how to run a business corporation. And so I had to travel. We had to travel, or our core group had to travel to each village all over the Doyon region. So we were doing lots of traveling back and forth, up and down the road system, from all the ones on the highway, the Eagle, to down the Yukon River, up the Yukon River, the Tandon River, all the villages and corporations. And we were actively going out there for a number of years. I was just constantly working with village corporations. So it was a real eye-opening job. In 1976, I decided, well, I'm going to try to see if I can run for this Doyon board, which I did. And by the way, you know, I have to stop and say, you know, if I go back to look at where I grew up on riverboats freighting on the interior rivers. So we got to know lots of people up and down the rivers and kids. Same generation, we're all active young people working in the land claim settlement and in the governments, so we all knew each other. So when I ran for the board and my name appeared on the list, it was easy for me to get elected because everybody knew me. So if you look at some of the others and say, well, hey, they don't know anybody, people. But, oh, we know Sam because I was just at the right age. Oh, yeah, his dad and their mom used to and said, yeah, let's work for Sam. So I made it. I had no problem. And it was not, that was mainly due to myself. It was mainly due to I thank my mom and dad for the work we did that really got me elected on this. But I certainly became interested in the corporation of Doyon and served on that for about 13 years. And I also served as an officer and a board member in the village corporation. And so I was elected to some of the top offices in the Doyon Regional Corporation. I was chairman of the board there and acting president for a term. And 13 years as a board member. I was also elected to the board for the Village Corporation of Holy Cross and worked for them as the president for a year. And so during those time period, I was really busy in a lot of different things. And so, but this Claims Act, still today, 50 years later, there is still a lot of questions. I would say questions of why and what the Native people should do as it relates to the business, and what do we talk about as far as the Claims Act is concerned. And if, when I look at the corporations today, their main interest is business, because a lot of them have developed huge businesses and multi-million-dollar enterprises, and quite a number of regional corporations have billion dollars in revenue, and so they have gone way into a big business. And as we think about our world today, and the wars that are taking place in the Middle East, Iran and Iraq, and all of that, a lot of the government hires contractors to work in those areas for the military, providing information. There was a clause in the Congress to what's called 93638, and all it is contracting. It was available to minorities and Alaska and Claims Act corporations qualified. And so there are big businesses being hired by the federal military in big contracts that are owned by a village, regional and village corporations in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So So I remember we meaning Doyon was actively involved in. Oh, it was just an amazing experience to see how the ideas of the board members and people wanting to be involved with the regional corporations in Alaska because they had money to invest. So if you look at business, and if you want to start a business, you need money, capital. And so it was really a fun thing because we started we made a film called George Atla, and it was called Spirit of the Wind. So we said, well, we had people approaching us. We had one of our shareholders from Holy Cross was hired by, well, first of all, we said, well, let's make a movie about George Atla's life, because it's a unique situation. And it is a young Native kid growing up, and he has polio, I think it is. Or anyway, his leg is fused together and shortened by a few inches. And so his leg is stiff. But still it doesn't stop him from becoming a dog musher. In the 1950s and 40s, dog mushing was king in Alaska when it comes to outdoor sports. The Anchorage Fur Rendezvous and the Fur Rendezvous and the Fairbanks North American Dog Racing Derby, and a lot of sweepstakes. So the beginning of the Iditarod was, and but anyways, let's make a movie about George Atla's life. We'll call it Spirit of the Wind. And we had a film company come up and work with us, and we did. Doyon funded it. They made that thing, that movie. And it was, I remember we were invited to the premiere down in Hollywood or New York or whatever it was, but it was a big deal. And it ended up being really a good movie, because George ends up being a world championship dog muster and winning many championships in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. So it was really that's just one business that, so going into all kinds of other businesses. It was just for me, it was just a unique experience to be involved in. Shall we do this? We have now something from the construction industry. Shall we start let's start Doyon Construction, which we did. Big Doyon Construction coming, because Trans-Alaska Pipeline's going through, and you have all kinds of dirt moving, all kinds of construction going on. Money is pouring into Alaska, and so there was a big need for construction, dirt work. And then we had in this settlement, we had when you have the lands, the big discussion was, well, as when we develop the lands in the corporations, some corporations are going to do well because they have minerals, oil, gas, and timber. They're rich. Look at Southeast Alaska. Huge timber. Look at the North Slope. Prudhoe Bay is right next. It's all of the North Slope. Look at the interior. They had prospects. And we had a prospect over in the 40-mile country that was a asbestos load prospect. And when we drilled, when Doyon drilled and we sampled how big that load prospect for asbestos was, it was worth $1 billion in place. And we're having trouble thinking about how, we have a $30 or $40 million in the corporation, But when you talk about $1 billion, it's like you keel over. You know, you can't think about owning, controlling $1 billion. But that's what it was worth at, in place, in the ground. And then, a couple of years after, it was declared it was poisonous, it's going to cause cancer of the lungs, and no, nobody wanted asbestos no more. Just so our big discovery there and all that money is gone. So here, all this money we put into it was lost. So there were called what's called net operating loss. And that was taking place all over. Village corporations, regional corporations were losing a lot of money. And as you have an act like this, this big, there's always amendments to it. We've got to change this. We've got to do this because as the Native people implemented these corporations, the Congress could see, yes, we need to change this because it's not working. But anyway, that was one little thing that took place to help the corporations as they worked.
Did that affect that particular asbestos issue, that you could claim that as a net loss?
Yeah. So yeah, we thought, well, we have some loss, but the land man comes up and says, wait a minute, you guys have a big loss. She'll get it.
Yep.
You guys have a big loss, and that is the asbestos. Oh, could we claim it? We floated it by, and they said, yeah, you can claim that. So we have these losses, and just wipe out any taxes we have to pay. We don't have to pay any corporate taxes for we don't know how long, but you could sell net operating losses to other corporations that needed a tax break. And so that, you know, that was taking place. The thing goes on, you know, in Alaska we have reservations, Metlakatla, Tetlin, Vinatai, and they have a different settlement where they have their reservation. They now have as a corporation, they have that land. The difference is they own the surface and the subsurface rights to that land. Whereas in Doyon, it owns surface and subsurface of Doyon lands, but as they claim lands around the village, they own the surface. The village owns the subsurface. So do you see how they have to work together? If there's oil there, the village has a surface right. Doyon has the oil right, so they have to have a joint venture with whatever company they work with. You talk about a complicated situation the Native people found themselves in and still do. There's all of these different things. It's just this declaration of national security. No one heard about that, but that just took precedent over everything. Some reasons having more. Part of the Claims Act that was introduced was 7I and 7J, Section 7I and Section 7J. 7I is any corporation that develops its oil or gas or timber reserves has to share their profits with the other regions. They have to take 70% of that profit, 70%, and divide it according to the number of shareholders each region has, and send them a check. Take this. So and then you get to keep 30. A big disincentive and a big incentive, you know. So you get, what about the Aleutian Islands? Volcano islands, no timber, no oil, no gas, no nothing. Wind, and that's it. Or they're the ones that said, well, we need some help. And they did. Well, that's seven eye sharing. So now, as Doyon gets its seven eye share from, let's say, Nana, which Nana has developed a big mine, and it's called Red Dog Mine, and they've been sending out millions of dollars of net profit to the regions. Each region has to take their seven eye sharing and divide that up to each village the same way. Just not the same way, but to each village they get seven eye sharing from Doyon. So you can see that Doyon has to now have a big staff. You have not only the business development, the land development, stockholder records, and prospects related to oil and gas, but how do you take care of your land surveys, all your businesses, and you have to have big stockholder records, you have to have that, but accounting firms and legal firms, legal advice, so it ends up being a huge thing to try to control. And it just, you know, the thing just keeps going on and on. And as I look at it, you know, if I listen to regional corporation or AF, Alaska Federation, if I go down to the gym, all they're talking about is business. They're talking about money. They're talking about development, which is, they were established to do that. A profit corporation. So now is it subsistence living? No. Corporation is profit. So let TCC and let the villages and let IBA and all those other nonprofits work with the village as relates to village life and subsistence. Now, in the beginning, I have to say that as early board members, we determined that our corporation, meaning Doyon Limited, and the village corporation said in their mission statement that they will continue to support the cultural and traditional ways of the people. So they supported that. But now, if you look at their mission statement, it pretty much says, well, that portion kind of sink way over here off to the side, and it's mainly business development, which is logical because it's a profit corporation. So I think that if I talk about, I can talk about, you know, the older people in the region, all over the state, they can tell you about how the Native people live, but I come from a second generation Alaskan family that lived in the 40s, and they were being introduced, and they were the ones that seen people going up the Yukon River, and they could see these guys were marrying into Native families, and they were staying in Alaska. So they're at that time in the 40s and 50s, we lived on the Yukon River, and we never counted the fish, or we didn't, how the hell were we gonna count fish on the Yukon River? But we knew there was an immense number of fish that you never have to worry about fishing, overfishing. I remember going down to fish camp in the 1940s and going to fish camp, and we put our fish reel out there, and it would be running, and you could see it catching 3-4 salmon per turn. Wow. That was just pumping, jumping fuel during the run, and there are little 12 by 4 by 4 basket just filled right up overnight, and you'd have to stop the wheel because it was overflowing. It's just, fish are just falling off. There are no fish in the salmon, fished king salmon last year at all, anywhere on the Yukon River. This year there's going to be no fishing again. So now, so what are we, how, what are we faced with? And I'm getting to the point, to this point in my life, and I think a lot of older people are, is we have elders that say, well, there's going to come a time in our lives when we will see big changes. And one of them is going to be a time when there's going to be a law or a regulation that something that says, you will be owned, you can own land, and you'll be tied to ownership rights, and it relates to your family, and it relates to your village. And if you you will own it, and if something happens, it's going to be transferred to your children. And of course, back then, you know, nobody knew what they're talking about. They just, the elders just said, it's going to take place. And it's going to be a big issue. It's going to be a lot of trouble. And you'll fight villages against villages and people against people, and it's no good. It's not going to be a good thing. And they all foretold also that there's going to be changes in the weather. It's going to get warmer. Strange animals come in the country. Anyway, they had a lot of old people talking about these things, and I think the older people in this, in Alaska, you know, remember those things. And they see how corporations are going, and they're multi-million dollar corporations that are big business, and they work big business. So there is a, and I wonder about how things are going to work out.
Could I ask you to go back to that Interior Village Association?
And yeah.
What were some of your experiences when you did that with some of the villages you visited, some of the issues that they dealt with?
Yeah. The main issue for the village back then was selecting their land. And finding, making, establishing a land record system where they could show to their shareholders and anyone else, here's the village corporation land selection and its location on a map. And here's the survey description, physical description of the land. So that took surveying and identifying the different areas that is blocked off with doyon in the village. So the Interior Village Association had a land man, and they went out there and worked with each village to hire surveyors and to make sure that each village had a land record system they could have in the office that they could even share with their shareholders, saying, here's the land that the village corporation owns. So people would know, okay, this is our land. That area right next to my allotment is village corporation land. No, I didn't know that. So they know if they start. So that's one thing Interior Villages had to do, was to work with land selections. And the other one was business development. So we had to have business development person there that went out. And as a village corporation wanted to try to go into some kind of business, How do you do it? What shall we, here's what we want to do, how do we do it? And so you have to, yeah.
So would the village have an idea for what they wanted to do? Like in Holy Cross, did they say, oh, we want to start a tourism business?
Yeah, they did that. They did that. They did, one of the things that they set up, first of all, was let's set up a fish plant and we could sell fish because, hey, we got all these fish in the Yukoner, millions of fish. So now that started right from the mouth of the Yukon River all the way up to Fort Yukon, I think. Almost at Fort Yukon, I think there were all the villages, most of the villages long had established a business that was tied to the village corporation, and it worked for a while, but after a while, you know, when you have people that are used to living and working with the seasons of the year. So, you know, I remember going to a congressional, U.S. congressional subcommittee meeting here in Fairbanks at UAF, and the meeting topic was, what is the definition of subsistence as it relates to the corporations? And what is it? And they're saying, well, it's hunting and fishing, and it's just, it's going off, it's a number of different things. And so Congress, and they had congressional senators and Congress people up here, and they're up there. And I remember going up there with someone, another person, we went and said, let's go listen to this hearing and see what they come up with. Because people were saying, I remember that one of the governors from the Bay of Penn said, well, I know, I can tell you what subsistence is. It's hunting and fishing. It's fish and game. That's what subsistence is. That's the first day, you know, that was dead silence in the whole AFN meeting. You have hundreds of people there. And there's subsistence is not fish and game. Anyway, this person that came into the subcommittee said that you want to know what subsistence is, I will tell you. My name is so-and-so, and I'm from Kaikuk River. Subsistence is me when I, summertime, springtime comes, I'm ready to go out to spring camp. I'm ready to get ready to go out to the summer camp. And I start getting ready and making sure all my nets are in order, and I get ready for the whole summer. And I know that my wife's going to be picking berries, and we have to get the boat ready. So I prepare all spring for summer work, summer activity. And then as summer goes along, get towards the end of summer, we start preparing for the fall. Cut wood, store it, go out, get your trapping gear ready, get things ready, go out picking berries, get ready for the winter. As winter, fall comes, you get ready for the winter. So he described pretty much in detail how he lives his life through the whole season. And he said, so my life is just living year to year according to the seasons as it requires me to make my life so I can live. That's subsistence. And so, now, when I think of subsistence living, subsistence is an English word meaning do something for yourself so you keep alive. Subsist. But in an indigenous person in the world, wherever you come from in the world, you lived according to the seasons of the year, fishing, going out whaling, going out whatever it is, you know, planting gardens, everything. So our definition of subsistence is the way the native people lived on the land for centuries, according to the seasons. So how do you write that up? You know?
Yeah.
And so Congress did was they took that thing on subsistence and they took it out of the Claims Act, which was written right into the Claims Act as the most, one of the most vital important things, was to make sure we have the ability to keep on living that way. It was taken out. And AFN fought to keep that back in. Hunting and fishing is the traditional way we did for reservational for lots of years. And so we fought, but could not get that reinstated. So it's still that way today.
Yeah.
And we still now are suffering under the fact that if you go over to Canada,
yeah,
Canada and their land settlement gave that hunting and fishing right to every native person. So they can go out and hunt and fish and live the way they used to and still can do it today. They have the right to over anyone else, over any other Canadian. They have the right to do this. So that was gone. So on the further on the IBA was the land claims, land selection and surveying and setting up of records, business development as relates to whatever the village wants to get involved in. We talked about the fish canneries. Mm-hmm. That happened. That's worked for a while until people got tired of working in those. And then fish started diminishing, so they just shut it down. And there were lots of others. I remember there was one village bought out a lodge on the highway and bought the lodge and said, well, we're going to go into business, we're going to buy this lodge, run it. And they did that and realized, well, you got to be in this thing year round. You got to be able to help people year round. You got to be happy and smiling, and you got to be making the beds and cooking food. And people were used doing that, so that didn't last very long, you know. So there were lots of things like that taking place. And I remember we went up to a village corporation building and had a little log cabin, and we walked in there, and it was just a, you know, table over here and a table over there and some desks, and they had their land, the records there, and we talked to them about business. And we went in there, in their little area, the little, where we had a couple of chairs, was stacked with all these boxes. Oh, geez, we had to kind of walk around the boxes, and we worked with them on the village corporation for a while. And they said, what do you got? Did you get an order? And they said, oh, yeah. One of the people that was running in the office got a call from somebody selling stuff over the phone. Cassettes, blank cassettes, cheap. And back then, they had cassettes, songs, rock and roll songs, and cassette things you can record mm-hmm. on. And so the person at the village got this smooth-talking guy that said, I'm going to sell you a whole box of them, reduced price, cheap, only so many, and I could send you a whole lot of it. A lot. Gee, that's a good idea. We could do that. So they agreed, and here comes this pallet on the airplane, and it comes in, and what's this? Boxes and boxes of blank tapes. Where'd this come from? Anyway, you see that how it was easy to, so there had to be rules. Quick rules and regulations relating to no one can do this. No one can agree to some good deal without bringing it to the board of directors. And so how does a village corporation board work? How does a board meeting work? And so the business, IVA business people realized we have to have basic rules of how do Robert's rules of order work in a meeting? Because each meeting had to have a record of the meeting, the actions that took place, and it has to be recorded for the business. Mm-hmm. And now, money's come into the corporation, there has to be an accounting of the money and how it's spent. So you can report that to your owners, who are the shareholders. So it has to be a big accounting service, which IVA had, helping set up books and how you... And there was a requirement by the federal government in the Claims Act that each corporation had to account for money and a report to them.
Mm.
So, right, auditing people in the business of running business audits, and they had a whole gold mine of, now every village had to hire an accounting firm come up, and then we had to set up training for the village corporations on how to run a board meeting and how to record it and make sure you have it stored in a proper place. And so let me see, other things in the village?
Well, on that point there, when you went out to the villages, what was your specific job?
My job, I was hired as the president of the nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
And it was mainly because, once again, because I was on the Doyon board, I was
known.
Well known, and okay, I have a lot of training from the Doyon board. So this guy, he knows this. And when I met with the IBA board, they said, you have a lot of experience in working with people in all villages. I said, yeah, I do. And they said, well, good. You actually know a lot of people. You've been to most all the villages. I said, yeah. So I got hired just like that. He said, yeah, you're just a guy. So I got hired on, and when I went over, got introduced to the people at IVA, and there was like 13 or 14 employees there. They said, so you know all the people in all the villages? And I said, yeah, pretty much. They said, good, excellent. Now we don't have to, oh my God, thank you. So we're going to Fort Yukon. I said, okay, good. So we're going up there, and what are you doing here, Sam? Steve Guinness. And all the people in Fort Yukon that I knew, well, good, so what are you doing here? I work for the Village IVA. Oh, the Village Corporation. Yeah, good, God. So yeah, go down there and start working with them. And it was just a revisiting of people that I knew from school or met some way from Mount Edgecombe, Sheldon Jackson, Copper Valley School, Fairbanks High School, any place that you went, Point Barrow from Nome, Kotzebue, all over. Kids were there, and we all played basketball together. And so I would go up there and, oh, gosh, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Well, I married so-and-so, and I'm from so-and-so village. And so, anyway, it was a... I have to tell you about one thing that was really an important thing that took place that took a real effort, a real use of all of IVA's employees, was when some villages in the Doyon region wanted to merge together. Smaller villages wanted to join together and become one bigger village. So we had to look at the Title 16 on mergers and things relating to corporations, and we had to follow that, those requirements, study that. And we met with McGrath, Tolida, MTNT, McGrath, Tolida, Nikolai, and Takotna. Those four villages, we had to go out there and meet with each village and agree, have them agree that yes, they want to merge. So we had to, meaning IVA, had to set up, and the requirement under the statute was that each village board had to actively be in open meeting on record together at the same time in each village. And so we said, well, we have to have persons on what needs to be required to merge in each village. So we had to have two employees here, two employees there, two employees there, two employees there. And we all had to get on the phone, because we didn't have computers then. At least we didn't. And we got on the phone, and we had to have a speakerphone, so we had to have the people in each one of those villages in an active meeting, opening and making the motions to merge and voting on the merger, and it had to be approved and recorded on a recorder and in each board member's rooms on record. And now that take a lot of effort.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
We had to fly out there. We had to make sure we're all there, make sure each village had a quorum of the board present, which was, some cases, difficult. Have people come in, because
right.
They had to pay them to come in, put them up there, and they had to be in the meeting, in the boardroom. And so we did that three times. McGrath, Nikolai, Takotna, and Tolida, and then Ganyu, which is Galena, Kayakuk, anyway, the four villages around Galena merged into what's called Ganyu. And it's a big village corporation now. And a big successful village corporation.
Yeah. And what was the third?
Oh, the third one was Koitlajina. That was all the villages along the Kaikuk River. Hustia, Hughes, Alakakit, and Latna. We had to have them all on the phone do the same thing. And so we were able to get all of those merged. And Coach Elijah has an office here in Fairbanks on College Drive. Ganyu has a big office in Galena. And MTNT has a big office in McGrath.
So, Sam, you were at those meetings?
Yeah, and I was in one location, a location that they said, well, you need to have, we need you here. And other people, they had two people in all the other places. Uh-huh. So we all had to farm out, travel there, get them all together, have them all together, call up, get them on the phone, and have them start doing this whole thing.
Why did you decide to do it that way instead of bringing the boards from those villages physically into one place?
Well, we could have done that. But they said, they meaning the description under the statute said you just have those boards meet, and in our case as well, it's going to be too much of a trouble for them to get all them together to get wherever to come all to come together
to Fairbanks or
in
something.
Fairbanks or wherever there might be. It'd be easy for us to just go out there, which they agreed on.
And how well have the mergers worked?
Good. All of them are doing well. And there was one attempt, I think, Holy Cross, Shagluck, Agar, Hendrick, and Grayling were really contemplating seriously, because I was a member of the Village Corporation Board down there, and we wanted to merge. And but we couldn't get the other ones to agree. A couple of them would agree, the other two would not agree. Then we had three agree, one didn't want to agree. So it just went on like that, and it just stalled. And then mergers, closed. You couldn't do them anymore.
Oh, there was a time limit on
it. I think there was a time limit because they stopped doing it. Either that or the corporation got successful enough where they said, we don't want to do anything else anymore, we're good.
When you were working with the BIA, were you involved in land claims issues there too?
When I went to work for the BIA, pretty much the land claims were issues were pretty much over. There were minor amendments made that didn't have any big issues relating to the whole of the state. So when I worked at the BIA, one of the major things that we did at the BIA was I was superintendent of the Fairbanks Agency, which is all the interior and the North Slope. There was a Southeast Alaska Anchorage Agency and the Bethel Agency. So I, and being in Fairbanks, had to travel to all the North Slope villages to work with them with BIA matters. And the lady that was in Assistant Secretary of the Interior, which was the commissioner of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was, try to say all that once, was Ada Deer. And what a great lady. What a person, a perfect person for the time. And because the villages were having a tough time being recognized by the federal government to qualify, and what they had to qualify was under in the Native people of the United States and Alaska. In the United States, they had what is called a special relationship with the United States of America, and that was there because they, America, realized they came into the country and they took over the lands with what is called manifest destiny. Mm. We have a God-given right to do this. And so the Indian Wars and all the things that relate to cowboys and Indians and how to kill all the Indians and all that took place. And then after that, they realized, or started realizing that, you know, the Native people are citizens, and we need to provide for them social, housing, health, and other things relating to help the individual families and tribes with money.
Yeah.
So all of those federally recognized tribes in the lower 48 got money from the Congress of the United States and divided it up to help their village, I mean, help their tribe. Now in the lower 48, it's much easier because they are now stuck on a reservation. You didn't have, you know, people, you know, they were wandering all over the world. So now you have tribes in Alaska, and they aren't federally recognized. They have a reservation system here. They're providing for Metlakatla, Tetlin, five different places. So there's federal recognition already. So Ada Deer talks to the Congress, says, we, the United States, need to recognize these village councils so they can qualify for what is already provided to Native tribes across America, recognition. So she established federal recognition, and we now have federally recognized tribes all over Alaska. They qualify for now money from the Congress too. How did the tribes in the lower 48 feel about this? I don't think they liked it very much, because I remember being the BI and I used to go to meetings. They said, "Where are you from, Sam?" Alaska. No. 200. We had 200 and some new tribes. We used to have all this money from the federal government. Now we have to divide that up to 200 of you guys. And I said, "Well, I didn't have any new business." Okay, well, yeah, it was a, no, working for the BIA was a whole different thing, because my mindset had to change. You know, I'm just a village kid, just playing in the mud down in Holy Cross. You know, I don't have no idea about Indiana. I didn't even know where Indiana was. But we, in our travel up down the Yukon River, went up and, oh, gee, that's where Mom's from. Mom is from Anvik, because we know where Anvik is, we know where the downriver village, but any beyond that, we didn't know nothing. So I'm just a kid. How am I supposed to be able to get along with running a village corporation, a regional corporation, helping with establishing regional and village corporations, working with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, working with the oil companies and the development of that, and then going to work for IBA, and then going to work for the BIA. And so when you're working federal government, it's a whole different thing. Now, you know, they say, "What are you doing here?" "Oh, I'm the BIA superintendent." "No, you aren't. Hell, don't you used to work for the Tarrant Village Association?" Yeah, I said, "Yeah, I used to." "What the hell are you doing?" So it was just a, oh my gosh, so now we have to deal with your federal, your Fed, huh? I said, "Yeah, trade soul." So now I have to sit down with negotiations with the Area Office of Alaska, meeting with each tribe, each tribal entity, to find out how much money they're going to be getting from the Congress of the United States. So each village has each so much money that they get for housing, health, welfare, etc. So now I'm not a good guy anymore. You're just one of those damn feds.
Well, even though you were facilitating the money coming in for these things.
Yeah. Well, anything else was it was really an eye-opening thing for me, just to being the reason why I said I'm a kid in the village.
Yeah.
We went to school, yeah, the Catholic school. And I remember, you know, talking when they first established, they meaning the Catholic Church established Holy Cross Mission, mm-hmm. when they came up along with the prospectors, they said they didn't find a site. And they said, "Well, what about these guys?" The Catholic bishop, Cremont, I think his name was, was coming up river, and they said, met with the village people of Holy Cross. They said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "We're going to establish a church." "What kind of church?" "Oh, Catholic church." "You mean like those, like from, like the people from, no." They met. I said, "No, we don't need no church." And so they met with the bishop and told him, "We don't need church. Let's keep on going. Keep going on upriver. We're good. We don't need a church. We're happy with the way we are." And then the guy that was guiding them told them, he said, "Bishop, you know, I know these people. Did you tell them you're going to establish a school too?" I said, "No, we didn't tell them that. They need a school and they need help because the pandemic, the epidemics that took place and killed people all over the whole state, you have people, they need, those kids need to go someplace and you can establish a mission and a school. Go back and tell them that. So they went back to them, established a school too and mission. Help with the kids that are orphaned. Okay. Come in. Well, now, here I am going to a Catholic mission school.
Yeah.
I'm a village boy. And all I do is play in mud. And,
yeah.
But now I'm going to Catholic church, Catholic school. End up in the Catholic school, Copper Valley. End up going to Fairbanks. I went to a school in Holy Cross, I mean, in Nenette for 3 years during the war years, 45, 3 years in Nenette, Franklin K. Lane School in Nenette. And I remember they used to have planes coming in from Lend-Lease, used to be flying over, buzzing, and they used to, those planes would fly out, some of them would fly under the railroad bridge and buzz the bridge. And I remember there in Nenette, and we could hear this, oh, it's the war airplanes. Hey, it's the Russians are coming. We all run down to the bank on the banks of the Nenette River, Tan River, and watch the Russian air, those American planes fly underneath the bridge and keep going.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that stopped because once the commander of the American forces in this Trans-Lend-Lease realized that everybody's diving under, they just know, oh, they couldn't tell the Russians. They had no command over the Russians. So the Russians flying the American planes, they could do whatever they want. If they were, that's why we would say, the Russians are coming. The rest of America, they're going straight to land, you know?
Yeah, right.
So that's kind of a...
So in that period, that 1993-94, when Ada Deer made that change or established federal recognition.
Yeah.
Then you were working for BIA then.
Yeah.
And you actually then had to try to implement that.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. They did most of the work there, her office, but I had, when she came up to Alaska, she went to the area office, the big office first,
yeah.
And all the agencies work under the area. And so whenever she flew up to Fairbanks, I had to accompany her. She gets right down there and you help her out. So I had to go with her out to the villages and set up the meetings with them, with her.
I didn't realize she actually traveled to the villages.
Oh, hell yeah, she did. I gotta tell you a little side thing. She came up and she said, well, how are you things going down? And she says, I'm from the Penobscot or the village, some tribe she's from. She says, yeah. I went out with my person that I knew in college in Anchorage and went out on a fishing charter. I said, oh yeah. She says, yeah. She said, we went on a fishing charter and we did good. There were six people on the fishing charter, six pasture boat. She says, me and my buddy, the other lady, we're the only people that caught fish. The other guys were men. And they were madder than hell, Sam. Because we're the only ones catching big king salmon. So I go home to my office, and I go home to my tribe, and I tell them about that. Next thing I know, I get from a tribal newspaper, and the headline says, Deer catches fish. Ada Deer,
yeah.
D-E-R, catches fish. And they have her with the big king salmon.
Oh, that's great.
That's great.
Well, I've often wondered about how important that recognition is today.
Oh, it is. It's money. It relates to federal funds. So, you know, they got funds, they were getting, the villages were getting, I don't think they were getting funds. I don't understand it quite exactly how that worked, but every village council that got federal recognition qualified for federal funds, health and welfare and housing and I don't know what else, yeah. But that was given to every other federally recognized tribe. Now you get, think of TCC, you know, TCC is nothing except a nonprofit association. It's there because all of those federally recognized tribes have got together and formed a group, and they call it the Ten and the Chiefs Conference. So everybody said, well, we go to TCC and they're going to tell us what to do. Well, TCC actually has to get their money from federal recognition from each of the villages.
I'll be there.
Yeah, they do.
What about in the areas of sovereignty and ability to control village affairs? Did that tribal recognition have impact in those areas?
You know, the sovereignty question was one that worked out for some tribes in the Lower 48, I think, and some other places, but it did not work out in Alaska because, let's see, it was Veenatai that sued the federal government for tribal, for sovereignty in its former reserve and settlement. And so the requirement by the federal government was that the Indian people there had to own, use and occupancy, use and occupy the land, which they did. They had no trouble there. They had to have a common language, which they did. There's one or two other things. And they were disqualified for having sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
and it was federal, it was a federal...
Over the land.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about in the area of child welfare and
village
affairs?
Each village has funds, federal funds, to help each tribal member with their health, social, mm-hmm. and housing, and other things that relate to the tribal members. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well,
how does the relationship with the tribes and the tribal organizations connect with the village corporation and the regional corporation and the requirements of ANCSA?
It depends on what you're going to do. And in the beginning, it was hard because a lot of the people didn't quite separate being a Doyon shareholder and being a village shareholder and being a village council member, and having to explain to each of your persons in the village that they belong to the village council, and they can, each village can qualify for housing for their village council members, or health clinic and other things, but they also have to hire their own corporation employees to work the village corporation business and records and everything else in the village corporation lands. And then you have Doyon lands wrapped all the way around your village. So if you're going to try to keep hunters out of your area, you have to have an agreement with the village and the council and the regional corporation saying, we're going to disallow people from hunting in this area. And they say, yes, well, you mm-hmm. can, we don't have any jurisdiction in Doyon lands, but Doyon said, well, if you do it that way, we'll support you. Mm-hmm. So there's agreement to work together.
Well, also challenges of each village doesn't have so many different people who can play all these different roles. So is one person a corporation employee and then on the tribal council, or do you have to have all different people?
Well, you can have multiple people. I was I was Village Corporation president and a Village Corporation board member, and still on the Duane Unlimited board member, and a member of the Holy Cross tribe. I didn't have active participation in the tribe, but I was a tribal member.
Right.
But, so, yeah, there's multiple people in villages that have different hats. And when you talk to them, they got to identify themselves, saying, I'm now talking with my Village Corporation hat. And, mm-hmm. you know.
It's very complicated.
It is. It's a, you know, if we just, what do we do? You know, I remember in the early days of going on that, the president then comes to the board and says, I've been asked, the president said, tell the board members, I've been asked for a contribution to a political party. A political party. And we're all saying, okay, how many Democrats do we have? How many Republicans? How many independents? Okay, well, what do we do? So they say, well, you're the executive. What do you think we should do? I know. We'll give $100 to him and $100 to him. Both of them. Good idea. So that lasted for a little while, you know, until, no, the thing, and so on the board, all of a sudden you have,
So it's become political.
Yeah. And so, we get people from the shareholder pool, they're saying, who do you guys support? Who does Doyon support in this governorship? What do you say? You know?
Well, is that the role of a corporation?
Well, they still ask. They said, well, and so we, you know, it's a big discussion among, well, we can't really, we are just not be involved, or we can just continue doing this. In some instances, there was a high political thing, and everybody on the board agreed we need to support this one person for these reasons, and they did. But they would stop. They'd say, no, after that, no more, you know. Mm-hmm. So you still had people calling up and saying, well, how did the Village Corporation do with the political thing? And so it was just a, still happens, you know, it just,
it's difficult.
What do you do with this pandemic thing? And what do you do with the war in Iraq? And how do we continue to live? All they want to do is make profit. And so, in order for Bush, one of the Bush guys, to get the economy going, he said, well, all you have to do is have a war going, and the economy will come back.
Well, you did what? You mentioned that about the getting the federal contracts with the military, for instance,
yeah.
Or how the board is investing in businesses. And I was wondering, do the board members come up with the ideas that, oh, there's this business we should invest, we should start doing military contracts? Or do outside business people come to the board and apply and say, I'm looking for investors, can you guys help me?
Every single way.
Okay.
Anybody could come in. Individuals come in to talk to a board member over there and say, hey, you think you guys should be interested in this? So we're getting things from all over. So Noyon had what was called an investment committee. And the committee was set up to hear all those proposals of how and what they should do. So, you know, Doyon, there was board members and some Doyon shareholders lived in Hawaii. And they come back and say, hey, there was a prospect, one of the big resorts on Maui, Hawaii is for sale. It's called Pioneer Inn. And we should consider it. You mean buy the Pioneer Inn? So, okay, good investment committee. The investment committee was doing all kinds of other stuff. They put on there and said, call them up, call up the owners of Pioneer Inn. You know what Pioneer is? Pioneer Inn is? You?
Mm-mm.
Well, Pioneer Inn on Maui is a big established whaling resort hotel for when whaling was real hot and coming through the
right.
That thing also relates to our land settlement is the first oil rush in
the whale
United
oil
state was whale oil.
Right.
And they fished out all the whales in the Atlantic and came over to the Pacific, fished all the whales out in the Pacific, and they're stopping in Hawaii and they're stopping in the Pioneer Inn. They're going all the way to Alaska, mm-hmm. They're going up on the North Slope to Barrow and all this thing. Mm-hmm. And they go up there, and 3 or 4 years they're there, the first guy went up, they came back and said, all the way back to Boston, oh my God, lots of whales up there in the north, in Alaska. So next year there were more ships all the way down around the Horn, all the way up to Alaska. And the only trouble is in Alaska, there's a window you can go into the Arctic Ocean where the whales are. And you have to be very careful because when the wind changes and that ice pack moves in, you're done for. You got to be out of there. So on the first trip they're coming back and they stopped along the way at St. Lawrence Island. They stopped and one of the whale ships stopped and got some water and talked to the native people on St. Lawrence Island and made friends with them. Said, gee, you know, we need water, we need this. They said, yeah, we'll help you. Here, you eat this, try this stuff out. Here's stuff other, the native people there in St. Lawrence Island helped this one guy or a couple of ships and made good friends. Back to the thing, next year they come up, they're up there, and you got more ships. They go on up past St. Lawrence Island, past Diomedes, into thing. The thing changes, the ice pack moves in early, and a lot of the ships are trapped in Barrow. And there's a book called The Last Voyage. It's these trapped ships, lots of them, with their wives and kids on those ships. This guy comes down, and he makes it through, and he goes, St. Lawrence Island, go see my friend. They go in there, looks like it's closed. Going around, they have a few people. They go knock on their friend. Goes in, his bad shape. What's wrong? Is there a sickness? No, he said, we can't. We have our main food was walrus. We hunt that. That's our main food here. And we hunted this winter and they're all gone. The ship's captain said when they were up there and when they had that, there was hardly any whales, there was thousands of walruses and they started whaling the walruses. Mm-hmm. And they rendered down, they just killed off thousands of walruses and just got the oil from the walruses. In other words, collapsed the walrus run, and those guys from St. Lawrence Island were starving to death. And that whaling captain realized it. He said, what we did was we kill off all these, what they live on.
Yeah.
He said, I'm never coming back here again. I'm never going to do this again. So he swore off and went. Anyway.
But the Pioneer Inn.
Oh, the Pioneer Inn. Yeah. We went out, we bought it.
Yeah, did we buy it?
Yeah, we bought it. And, we could not ever own the land. And we figured, if we buy it, eventually the guys, the owners, well, the family will send it to us. We bought it and kept it and worked it and for a number of years kept it. Finally, we couldn't buy it, so we sold it back. Sold it. I don't know if we sold back then, but one of the things we did was when we were working on the North Slope, we got some of the oil. Doyen got a percentage of the oil going through the pipeline, raw oil, would come, we would be able to take off and have for our own.
Huh.
So we got paid for it as it was being pumped down. Our plan was to start a refinery, and we were going to start also a natural gas company called China Natural Gas. We set up the China Natural Gas. It was a real company set up for operation here in Fairbanks to sell dry gas to Fairbanks and then up and down. And we were going to do our own refinery. And we approached Refinery Orchard, North
Flint Hills.
I forget what the hell they call it, but anyway, approach them. Yeah. We'll sell it. Yes. It was like $50 million. And we're at the high point of our operations. We had a whole bunch of business, all kinds of business. We had international surveying company, places all over the world, surveying company. We had this film, we had a whole bunch of things going on, doing construction. We were talking about this refinery, and we were talking about a drilling company too, because the drilling business was going full blast up on the North Slope. And so, no, too much money. The board said, no, it's too much money. Why don't we build our own refinery? Why don't we? So we send inquiries down to Canada, where place where they build their, there's a big city there, anyway, where they build drill rigs, and they said, yeah, we can build a drill rig, and you can get, there's refineries in the Seattle area. There was one there, idled, all the components there. Let's buy that and we'll build our own damn rig, which we did. We bought it and started moving it up into Canada. And by then, Flint Hills says, well, what about you guys? Are you guys still interested in this thing? And so our executives come back and say, well, maybe we should stop this thing, and because it's a big deal. We're going to have to get all these things up, and we're paying all the storage fees for it in Canada now. Let's ask them again. So they did. Ask them about terms. Well, okay, well, we're still interested. What is it? And the price went up, way out of our, brought it back to the board. The board was, in other words, they don't want to sell it. They don't, they're asking way too much money. And well, if they just say, well, if they have so much money, they'll buy it. We'll make a hell of a profit and let them have it and we'll go on. So we said, no. So we, nope. And then back to drill rig. So now we're going, okay, we're going to drill rig. No, we're going to, by then, we had, and that's where we needed this oil supply. A little portion of oil that was coming off the pipeline was going to go into this drill rig that we had over here. And so we said, okay, stop. Then all of a sudden, doing construction is starting to lose money by the hundreds of thousands a month. Wow. And so, in other words, all of a sudden we start seeing things as high tech, international technology of serving is going down, and things are starting to happen. We're sold by your end, and in other words, things are looking bleak. And we didn't want to do. So we ended up selling that refinery parts. Like a loss, sold it, got rid of it. And then what we thought of was, well, we then heard of approach by Zach and Joris Brinkerhoff. Brinkerhoff Drilling Company. Drillers all over the world. And they approached us and, well, we'd like to, and we talked to them and said, geez, maybe we could start a joint venture. Drill rigs. And there, Zach is the main guy, the man that started the Brinkerhoff. Joris is his son. And so they're the two primary in the Brinkerhoff drilling. And they have drill rigs up there. Said, well, if we go into a joint venture, we'll have more access because ARCO and all those companies want to do business with the Hanks corporations. It does them good. And besides that, one of them, the North Slope, has a segment of oil, of the what ends Anwar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Segment. There's a segment there that belongs to the whole, all of the regional corporations. And if we, that can be, drillers can be used there because the owners will. So there was a short story is, yes, we started a drilling company and it was a joint venture between Joris Brinkerhoff's and Doyle Unlimited. We would own 50% and they would own 49%. And yeah, how do you do that? And we said, well, we're going to be doing this. And they said, we'll do it. So now Doyon Drilling now entered a venture with the Brinkerhoff family and was called Doyon Drilling Joint Venture. Now I remember we decided to build a drill rig ourselves. I remember I was chairman down in the, we went down there, we commissioned to drill a, what's called Drill Rig 9. And it was a state-of-art drill rig. And I remember when they finished, and I still can't think of that big Calgary, I think.
Yeah.
There, that's where they drilled, build the drill rigs. And they said, well, the drill rig is done, and we're going to commission it. And you guys want to come down, the constructors? And George said, yeah, we're coming down. Hey, you guys, who's the, yeah, Sam, you get some people, we're going down. We'll get on a plane, go down there, and you guys got to be there, you commission it. So I went down there, and there's a brand new drill rig, Doyon Drill Rig number 9. We had this, yeah, of course he had to have a bottle of champagne to crack it over the thing, and oh my God, what a, you ever meet a rich millionaire Texan type foreign oil baron with zillions of dollars with a gold, he doesn't care about money. I remember one time brought to, okay, yeah, a little joint venture meeting. Okay, guys, hey, you guys ever see this? Hold on. She bought wine, champagne, I think it was. Yeah, well, we don't drink here. We don't drink in the boardroom. And he said, no, I'm talking about drinking. And he said, do you ever see the movies where they take the bottle? Guy holds his sword and just takes this and goes, whack.
Cuts the top off.
Cuts the top off and drinks. And believe it or not, we're there and said, yeah, I've heard about that. He says, I'm going to do that. Then he goes around, picks up and pulls out the sword. Now, we were here, me and some of the board members, and I'm wondering, this guy's nuts. Well, no, he's not nuts. He's just rich. And he goes, okay. We got a rag around it and print them. Well, it's all busted up. And thunk, bust it all up. Thunk, bust it all up. He says, this is a knack to it, you know, I'm going to get it. So he's doing, he finally hits one and it just chops that thing, flies right off, and there. We can drink.
He drank it up?
That's right. Anyway, that's just a kind of personality we were dealing with. You know, he just.
Crazy stuff.
We were in the, yeah. We were going to buy Western Airlines. Remember, Alaska International Air, EIA,
yeah.
Was what was that guy that ran it? That ran all those. Some other. The guy ran all. There was during the.
Burke was it?
Huh?
Was it Burke?
No, he.
Yeah,
was,
it was Burke. Neil Burke.
No,
Neil Burke.
I thought he was Ween.
No, Neil Burke was the guy who was running AIH, and he had all those Hercules. Flying just every day up the slope, and he run that. And he got us interested in, hey, you guys should be interested in Western Airlines. And so, of course, investment committee, and we got to look at that, and we had Western Airlines hats and jackets and our, you know, again, all this crap about, and but anyway, it was just a refinery. Zorro drill rig number 9, and owning all of the worldwide drilling records are owned by Doyon Drilling now, which we, in the setup of the venture, they said if we ever separate ways, one will offer to buy the other, or the other will buy the other. So that first right of refusal. So it worked out, and we bought out Brinkerhoff, and now it's Doyon Drilling.
Well, those are good examples of the big difference between the earlier generation living off the land and then knowing all that boardroom stuff and those business decisions and, say, how to run a meeting. I mean, that was such a big difference.
Hell yes, that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, I mean, and then working with the federal government, you know, and then working with the village corporations, and then I was also appointed to Alaska State Board of Fisheries by Governor Hammond when he was working there. So I was on a state board, going to state board meetings with fisheries, so I was hired to establish a limited entry commission on the Yukon River for during the time they were selling fish, and everybody had to have fishing limited entry license, and I was the guy hired by TCC after I was finished working there to establish limited entry license, and I had to go to the state board meetings relating to fisheries and seeing minutes of the state board being shown films from the United States Coast Guard of the international fishing trawlers from Russia, Taiwan, all those places. These big massive ships would have 20-mile nets. They're 20 to 30 miles long. Now, I erased the 30 miles, but people said, no, they are 30 miles. But we do have ones that were 20 miles long, and they're big, huge nets made out of monofilament. And as soon as they see a Coast Guard plane coming, they cut the lines and just keep going. And so when the Coast Guard lands in your net, they said, no, we don't have no net. And they fixed the net so there's nothing on it. Wow. Those nets are what are called, term for the board and by the Coast Guard, veils of death. That's what they're called. And they're out there fishing now. If they cut them, they don't plan on going picking that net up, because it's full of every fish that can get caught in there.
What a tragedy.
Dolphins, everything, fish, all the big, small, and all the things that you see in the ocean are stuck in there. They just die.
Yeah. Well, Sam, there's a lot more to talk about.
Well, I know. Look at the time.
We've run you pretty ragged here for 2 hours. 2 hours, almost 2.5 hours. We probably should call it. But thank you. This has been very rich.
Yeah.
There's
unless
a lot.
You want to summarize with something on the future of the what's going to happen with the ANCSA legacy and the corporations.
Yeah, this whole thing. Yeah, I do want to summarize by saying at this point in my life, I'm 82 years old, and I have a lot of experience working with the federal government, the state government, the tribal governments, the tribal corporations, and pipeline, the oil companies. But I see the trouble that the corporations, the profit inks or corporations are going to have is with the native people that live now and that are going to be born in the future. None of them will be owners of the land and will not be able to share in the profit that the corporations are set up to make. The profit is going to be so diminished by so many thousands of shareholders that it's hardly going to be worth being a shareholder. And now, being a Native person, and you talk to about the Native politics, it's regional corporations. Now in the AFN, they talk about business. They don't generally talk about. So my view is that I think back to talking to lots of Native elders and people in the villages, and they say, well, times are coming where there's going to be big changes in the world. And in Alaska, we'll see strange animals come to the country. Now, when we went on our trip, Karen, and we seen what's happening to the boreal forest and what's happening to fisheries and wood, especially on the Yukon rivers, there's changes.
Right.
And we document it. We know it. And it's changing. And it continues to change. So my concern is, are we, meaning the people of the earth, going to have a place to live? Because I want to point out one thing. When the pandemic was declared a pandemic in 2020, I think it was, all the flights, national and international flights, stopped. And I think you might even remember it, that all they showed a map of active flights all over the United States, and all these dots, that's active flights, people flying. And after that declaration, about 3 days later, there's none. There's no jets. And it stopped because of the pandemic. And what happens a few days after that? Los Angeles and all the north, the east, west coast, the smog was dissipating. Now, that tells you, all you have to shut this down and you can start breathing again. That tells me, and you know, you're asking me what about the future of ANCSA. ANCSA is business development. Business development equates to demise of our environment. the air, the seas, and people. So I think that my concern is, I don't see the angst of corporations. I don't know how it's going to end up, but they're so big now, they're so entrenched in the world economy, and I'm talking about international economies. I don't know how they're going to ever be able to change. But they don't talk, usually don't talk too much about the subsistence way of life anymore. And we're sitting here and you and I know that's changing. We all been down on the river. So I see the only way that these inks or corporations are going to survive in any way is that they have to change their ownership laws that relate to shares. And I don't know how they're going to do that, because there are going to be people, many shareholders are going to fight it. But the only way I can see them keep on going, to include the new young Native people, by including them in this thing, is to get rid of those shares that equate to land ownership and business development.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.